soldiers and people who want to control and deceive know exactly the people who will disturb their plans.
That's right.
And those people are artists. They're the ones that tell the truth. Something that the society has got to protect.
Hello guys, and welcome back to another episode of This Thing Changed My Life. I'm here with an incredible guest. Would you like to introduce yourself, guest, please?
Hello, I'm Rachel Long. I am a poet. I don't know why we say that as if like, yeah, I'm kind of sorry, but I'm not. Hi, I'm Rachel Long. I am a poet.
Yes, I'm here with a poet and founder of Octavia Poetry Collection for Women of Colour, who's just released her debut poetry collection called My Darling from the Lions. Rachel, how you been? How you doing? How's quarantine life?
I had to edit an interview that I did for a literary magazine earlier, and I had written it a few months ago, and I was all like, the pace of life is so much slower, isn't it? And I was just like, I am highly on high alert and I'm anxious all the time, but I am well rested. So I've never been this rested, but also tired. But also I don't feel like that anymore. I feel very tired and I feel like everything just sort of woke up suddenly. I think after the second relaxing of lockdown.
Yeah.
And I feel like everything's just gone into overdrive. So I feel like I need a holiday, but I feel like I missed the holiday boat, the August holiday boat.
Wasn't everyone in Italy, Spain? I felt like everyone
was in Greece.
Yes.
Everyone went to Greece because you didn't have to quarantine when you got back. And I was like,
oh, that would be.
I'm sorry, did anyone listen? That's why. Yeah.
Literally, everyone was in some place called Positano. I don't even know where that is. But I was like, I just see houses on houses. I see mountains and the sea. And I'm just like, wow, I'm in East London, and I actually don't want to go anywhere yet, because I've said, if this is the year where I don't go on holiday, this is the year I don't go on holiday. I came back from Dubai literally a few days before I actually got the Rona. That was...
When was that? 1 month?
That was... So I came back beginning of March, and 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, I was gone completely. As soon as I got better, they were like, lockdown, you ain't going anywhere. So I actually haven't been to work since February. Because after the holiday, I went on holiday, that's it. So yeah, so now I'm like, do I want to go on holiday? No, I think I might go to Zanzibar, which is home for me, December. So that might be nice.
I hope you can, and I hope you can without a mask. Because how long's that flight? How many hours?
I mean, it's hard to get a direct flight there, but it's around 7-8. Yeah.
Yeah. Wearing a mask for that long when someone... Because planes are already, like, mad dirty. I already was doing the Naomi Campbell thing on planes.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I this is my normal life, like, so to actually have a reason to be doing all this. I actually really like wearing gloves in the supermarket. I like people not coming anywhere near me, no hugging. That's my kind of vibe anyway. I've been living like this for about
three years. Finally, everyone's on my wave.
Finally. Yeah, actually. All my friends are like, you knew. I was like, no, I just don't like getting dirty.
You've been prepping for this your whole life.
Just me and Naomi.
Your whole life. Perfect. So, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy that you're on here. I really just have three questions for you that I wanted to pose. Fire questions. The first thing that comes into your head, say it.
First okay.
Rachel, are you ready?
I am ready. I'm quite scared, but I am ready.
Okay, first question. To you, who is the greatest artist of all time? By artist, encompassing all the arts.
Okay, first thing that came into my head was Tracy Emin. In many ways, Tracy Emin's work changed my life. I'm thinking particularly of my bed, and how that got to like a womanness that before that I had never seen exhibited in kind of all its fullness and ugliness and filth for someone who's always washing their hands. Yeah, how womanhood doesn't have to be pretty, how it showed depression, but through a bed, through the medium of where we're supposed to find rest. Also, I'm thinking of her, all the people I ever slept with, her tent as well. I love the way she kind of deals with sexual politics, but without it feeling, maybe without it feeling political. And its honesty and its grit and its fullness. That's why.
Love it. Second question. Sticking maybe to the medium of the written word, you're a poet, so both prose and poetry. What is the greatest piece of text that you've read? This is not the best, and this is not maybe that it doesn't have to be the one that changed your life. It's just the one that you're like, that's it. This is it.
That's it. But I'm trying to stay true to the first thing that comes into my head, because otherwise I'll be like, I don't know.
No, you should do it.
I'm thinking now, okay, the greatest text of all time. Is that what you said? This is so hard. This is horrible. See, I'm starting to think about it. Don't think about it.
You can do the greatest book that you've read of all time.
But I kind of doesn't make that easier. That doesn't make it easier. You're offering it to me like, what about this way? And I'm like, that might be harder. In my head, just right now, I have basically the whole catalogue of James Baldwin's works in my head, and would find it really hard to choose one of them. I'm also thinking about America Is Not the Heart by Elaine Castillo. And I'm also thinking of perhaps all the catalogue of Toni Morrison and White Teeth by Zadie Smith.
Wow, you said all of them. You said, I'm giving
you... I know, I'm sorry, I cheated. I'm mad cheating. That's the only way I can get out of that it's one.
You're cheating. However, I will give it to you because there's nothing that you said there that I'll be like, you know. So I guess you get a leeway in that sense.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate all the leeway given.
And final question. It has to be my favorite question, which is, what is, whether it's a quote or something that maybe someone has told you or something you've read that you live by? I guess it's the sort of the code that you try and live your life by, or maybe a line that is very important to you, that you often think about and work towards, or maybe work against?
Again, that's really hard. I don't think I do have one. I probably have lots. Like, I'm not one of those people who like would have like maybe sticks a quote to their bedroom wall and then every morning kind of, and that's their mantra. Like, I don't.
I've just looked at value system or
I can only think of my sister saying it's not that deep. That helps. That helps in stressful times.
Yeah.
In my sister's voice, exactly. She's like, wait, it's not that deep. And I'm like, okay, but usually it is that deep. It's often deeper than she thinks it is most of the time.
I am also the person that says no, it is that deep. Okay, my friends tell me that all the time. I'm like, no, it is that deep. Why don't you guys care about anything?
I'm thinking about that, and then I'm also thinking about like kind of what would Jesus do. But someone once said to me, like, what would Warsan do, as in Warsan Sherry, the poet, who also, I love her work, and she was definitely a really influential poet to me. So sometimes I think, which is kind of embarrassing to say out loud, but like, what would Warsan do? Maybe in terms of like, writing or something.
To be honest, I quite like that.
It's okay, thank you.
Do you know why? Because I've had a lot of people who maybe have given Bible quotes, and I had, who else did I have that gave some really nice, there was one person that just gave a nice flowery statement, and I was like, oh yeah, but like, what would you do is just so like real, because in my head, I'm always thinking, all right, Raifa, what would Beyonce do? Like, you're lazy today, but what would Beyonce do? So that's,
it really helps. It helps, huh?
It actually does. So thank you very much for answering those amazing three questions.
Thank you for them. The rest of the day, I'm going to be like, you've got to come up with it. But I tried to stay true to my first things that came into my...
Like, there was somebody else who, like, by the end of the episode was like, actually, can I change my answer to... And I was like, no, that's it. That's it, I'm done. That's what you meant. You stick by it. Perfect. Thank you. Good to know what Rachel, you know, likes and what she thinks is good for the many greatest writers of that exist.
Yes.
So to get into the episode, I asked you a few questions with regards to the things that have changed your life and the different artistic mediums. And you actually gave a book that I'm so happy you gave, because it's actually a book that changed my life and literally... changed the trajectory of my career. So I'm a lawyer, and I read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was like, I think 12. I think it was like the second book in English I read, like big thick books. I didn't really speak English as a kid. So when I saw this, I was like, yes, finally.
Good.
Yeah.
I was worried that I was being, I don't know, like, yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad. I'm very, very glad to hear that.
Right, so To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, published in, I believe, 1960. Why did this book change your life?
It changed my life because I remember, similarly to you, being in, I think it was year eight, and it was probably my, I think it's like the second, novel that you read in English class, and I remember, I think the first one was like Holes. I can't remember who Holes is by, but
read Holes as well.
Did you? Yeah, they have the curriculums about things, like everyone gets the same education, which is I don't know, either a beautiful thing or really problematic. Because we have to, anyway, so I remember getting that book, and I tried to read that book years before. I'd always been, or kind of prided myself, even as a kid, as being a really good reader. I wasn't getting those red sticker books anymore. I was like, no easy books, no Biff and Chip anywhere. I was after all the gold stars, only for English. That was like my only gold star arena. So I had tried to read it. My dad had a copy on the bookshelf, and so I was like, I want to read that one, because it was kind of like one of the thick ones. And he said, I think you'd really like that. And I tried to read it, and it was too above my head. It was way too kind of complicated for me. And so I remember getting that book in English and being like, oh no, not this.
Yeah.
Not this one that I tried like years and years ago. And then I opened it, and then obviously I was then at a reading kind of level, understanding that I could access it rather than just showing off to myself about how thick the books I could read. So it changed my life, because I felt it gave, one, it's brilliantly written.
Yeah.
I think like the way that I felt completely immersed in a place and a time that I am not from and have no connection to, is so skillfully done.
I
think it was particularly influential to me because of the injustice in it and the injustices actually that it confronts and explores, and what I think it gave me a lot of language or understanding into some of the things that I had either seen or experienced and witnessed, even though not the same, but similar in their essence, which is to say racist and prejudice and ignorant. And I'd not read a book that did that before.
Yeah.
There's so many scenes that are still with me that I walk around with or I think about so much. Sometimes when I go to the wardrobe to get out like something to wear, I think the word the chiffer robe. And that's when the book, like, he's just breaking up the chiffer robe. And I don't know why, but I go to my wardrobe to go and be like, whoa, what am I going to wear today? And the word chiffer robe comes into my head.
Yeah.
But that's from that book. Of course, I don't call my wardrobe a chiffer robe. But the book does.
Yeah.
So I walk around with it all the time, like years and years and years and years later.
I think it might have been the age that we both read it, because I was given to it by my English teacher in year 7, and I remember reading it and it being a bit hard for me because I had literally just learned English and, you know, was fluent in it but wasn't at a really higher level of reading. But I agree, it did give me, I don't know if it gave me the language to understand what racism was, because I had already learned it in, like, I don't know, Black History Month. And but when you're a kid, they do it in a very fun way. They make drawings and they, you know, you dress up at in assembly. But this was the first time where I was so invested in Tom Robinson. I think that was the guy's name. And I remember it was the first time a book has given me a physical reaction, because I read it, and at the end, when, you know, you find out that he's been killed, I just threw the book. I threw it, and I was crying, because I was like, what? I thought he'd be free. You know, everybody realized at the trial, you know, who was actually guilty. So it gave me such a physical reaction that even though there are so many people who don't really enjoy the book, but for me, it was like, that book is special, because that book allowed words on a page to dictate my feelings, my actions, and, like, just also my philosophy of injustice. Mm-hmm. That, so I think, beautiful.
that is honestly beautiful. Have you had that reaction since? Did you say it was that the first time, or you've never had that? You've never had a physical reaction to a book.
So the second physical reaction was, I think, like, I went through a period of reading a lot of sob story books, like, you know, Ugly and A Boy Called It, that were being passed around in school. And it got to a point where I just became a bit desensitized to that, because I was like, oh, this book is telling me cry, right? It's doing everything to get me to cry. And I can sense that. Whereas To Kill a Mockingbird didn't. But a few years ago, I actually read for the first time Zora Neale Hurston's book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Right, so I read that around 3 years ago, and I didn't cry, but I just felt like, all I can say is maybe I was having a literary orgasm, because my whole body was like tingling at the end. I was crying, but it wasn't a sad ending, it was more so a woman. I remember specifically at the end, you know, she was sitting there looking out on her porch. And she was talking about tides and pulling everything inside of her. And the book finished. And I just was like tingling. I called my friend and I was like, this is the most powerful book I've read. I can't sit still. I remember finishing it Cafe Nero in Liverpool Street. There was a Cafe Nero outside of Liverpool Street. That's where I was. And I just was like, I can't breathe. This book is amazing. So yeah, I think that is also, I mean, that's one of my favorite books. So. Yeah, physical reaction is very important to me, and To Kill a Mockingbird definitely did that. So I'm very happy you chose it.
This is gorgeous, and this gives me such joy to hear, like, that you read like this, or that you can.
Yeah.
That's really that's stunning.
Because I'm just thinking, like, I can't imagine not. That's why every time someone tells me, oh, you know, like, I don't like reading, I'm like, no, you just haven't found the right book, or, you know, the right piece of poetry, or, yeah. So... Kill a Mockingbird. I'm very happy. The Cost of Heaven. I actually just read it today. Very short, but wow, very powerful. So why did you choose this?
So W.B. Yeats, The Cost of Heaven. I chose this because my headmistress in primary school, this was her favourite poem. And some mornings, I don't think it was every morning, well, I went to like a Catholic primary school. And so praying and sort of reciting things was sort of way up on the agenda. But in tandem, or just as important as reciting poetry to my headmistress. So that's given me a certain relationship between kind of like prayer and psalm, or role religion and faith and writing, I think, in a way, even if it's sort of kind of just under my conscious thinking. But she would make us, or certain kids, get up and then recite The Cloths of Heaven. And most of the kids like kind of stopped at like after the fourth line and kind of got like staggered, floor cross-legged on the hall floor, as we used to do in primary school, you know, to go back and sit on the floor because you didn't get something to get to an poem. Anyway, not the best way, I don't think, to teach and instill a love of poetry nonetheless. So I made this my kind of 7-year-old life mission, where I was going to get to the end of the poem and Mrs. Wiley was going to love me and I was going to be the golden girl, you know, more gold stars. So I did, and I remember getting to the end and then feeling such a sense of achievement that I could get to the end. I don't think I understood what the hell was going on.
I was going to ask, I was like, did you know?
No, I don't think I did. But what I did love was were the words, like the individual words. So even though I didn't know what they meant when they were all together in a line, or kind of what I was reciting, I really enjoyed like the shape and the sound of the words, because they're so ornate. And I think even though I wouldn't have known the word ornate, I could sense that they were. And so I enjoyed that about them. I think maybe almost like it's like when you're listening to maybe a song in another language, you don't know what it means, but you get the feeling, you get something essential about what's communicated through words and sound.
Yeah, I'm actually obsessed with Bollywood music, and most of it I don't understand, but it moves me to tears. Like, there's a particular song that I will listen to and I will cry so much. And I have no idea what they're saying to this day. I know it's about love somehow. But when I read this poem, The Cost of Heaven, it actually reminded me of one of your poems in your collection called Eight. And I think structure, I don't know what it is, but in The Cloths of Heaven, there is almost a halfway structure when he flips the narrative. And I just felt that, especially in Eight, because there's a psalm that goes through that poem, but I don't know how to say it. It just jumbles up the structure and the rhythm, which means that you're always, there are two perspectives almost feeding into each other. I'm not sure how I felt. I wonder if you could elaborate. Is that what you were trying to do with Eight?
I love that. I love that reading. And also, like every reading, everyone's reading and is really important. And you feel like I would not have made the connection between the two of them, but that doesn't mean that that's not going on. Like that. Like we're saying about formative years and kind of what our educations are and kind of what goes into there. That's absolutely not to say that subconsciously or unconsciously, a poem that I was kind of instilled to love kind of would come out in my own work, because that's in me. Yeah. Or the rhythms, if that was kind of a form of rhythm for me, that poem. So maybe you've just unlocked something, like not only poetic, but psychoanalytic as well, like some really deep stuff you've probably like unearthed.
I'm powerful, I see it.
I know, I definitely think, and that's why no reading of poetry is kind of, you know, wrong, or like, you know, that's not, it just means that I haven't, even as a poet, thought about that, but that doesn't mean it's not true. Mm. I didn't do that on purpose, as I said, but I don't deny that's probably there. What I wanted to do with A, and this is what I think I'm doing, so the poem is often smarter than the writer, or the writing is often smarter than the writer, or it'll have its own life and will do what it wants to do, and you just have to kind of be with it and listen to it and go along with it and then shape it where it needs to be shaped thereafter. Yeah. But what I was trying to do, I think, was trying to... What was I trying to do with that poem? I did want the psalm... So it's Psalm 51, which is a psalm of, like, cleansing and asking God for forgiveness.
Yeah.
And a particular line, "Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow." Mm. And I think... again, that's a psalm that I kind of always grew up with. My mum would always say that before praying, a sort of like a cleansing, or so forgive me first, and now I can ask you for something.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So that line, "Wash me and I should write," so always kind of stayed with me, because I think for many reasons, and for a reason that I kind of explore in A, I always felt dirty or not clean. And that I would never be white in the snow. And another thing about kind of like race also runs through the book as well. And so there's that. So I did want a poem that knitted that, or kind of was in either collusion or confrontation with this kind of running throughout it. And it's brokenness that I play with in the poem.
Yeah.
Is because...
As well.
Yeah, so the sentence starts and then won't finish, and then it gets mixed up. I wanted to play around with that for pace. Mm-hmm. Kind of if what happens if you're sort of cornered or running and you have to get this psalm out quickly so that you will be kind of cleansed or saved, but then it's, you're trying to say it so fast that it starts to trip up, or you start to stutter and stammer with it. And also because, like, breaking it up and fragmenting it is kind of how it felt most true to what's going on in the poem.
Hmm.
That you wouldn't be able to get to the end of the psalm, or what happens, or what does it mean when a psalm is like broken, or a girl is broken.
Mm-hmm.
Playing around with stuff like that.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, just the first line, I read it and I was like, oh, I'm going to love this one. That's how my poetry is. I'll read the first line, I'll be like, this one's not for me. And I read this one and it said, "This memory can't skip, it hops." And there is an elongated space between "skip" and "it hops." And I said, oh, that's it. This is the one. I sat in bed and I was like, you know when you're just sleeping, and I just had to like get up from my seat because I was like, oh, I'm gonna enjoy this one.
I love your reactions to writing. I really loved it. I think you should, start documenting them. It's really yeah, it's like, this is what this line, and this is what it made me do.
Yeah, loved it. Right, moving on to the last thing. You actually already mentioned her, and I have a thing. I absolutely love reading dedications. I know so many people who just like, once the page is finished, I was like, they just put it down. And I always, I'm like, gosh, am I nosy?
They're like the same people that walk out.
That walk out of the cinema, right? So
yeah, that's what I was going to say. There, there's people who just like don't even wait to then. Where are you going? Like, why don't you care who made this film that you either will bitch about in the car or that you really loved, or one or the other? Just stay. I think they should start rolling the credits at the beginning and not the end.
Forcing people to like see who actually made the thing that they're going to love or hate.
Yeah, to acknowledge, to either say, yeah, just.
You know what, you're actually,
anyway, those people just quickly before you say this, some people have been messaging me and being like, I always read the acknowledgements before and like thank you, and like, what, who does that? That's it. Yeah, so many people. I was like, this is strange. I'm not judging it. Everyone can read where, however the hell they like, but they read the acknowledgements first and then the collection or the book.
Oh,
I think that's weird. No,
that's very weird. Right. So, last person who was.
Sorry, I completely hijacked that.
It's fine. Hijack. I always tell people who come on the show, they're not just a guest, they're a co-host.
I'm sorry. And they never get invited back because they try to hijack the show.
Please, you're next to rack, you're first on my list. What do you mean? So, Elaine. Hello, she's the author of America Is Not the Heart. You said that this person really changed your life and they're in your acknowledgement. So how do they do that?
She absolutely is in my acknowledgements. I met Elaine Castillo on my MA in creative and life writing. And I was not particularly enjoying that course in the sense that I felt like the reading list was still really stilted. I thought by a sort of MA stage then it would get, you know, really hot up, there would be some really kind of really brilliant mind-blowing writers, that there would be, you know, a few women at least. Not to mention where would any black or brown authors were. There were a few, might be like, ugh. Anyway, so the reading list was a really sort of, I felt, same old, same old. The other people's writing, some I was like really excited by, and some of the conversations were sometimes really stilted in that space. And then my girl, before she's my girl, opens her mouth and someone said something like kind of, you know, some kind of microaggressive, weird kind of, is that okay to say? No, it's not. I don't think about somebody else's work. Yeah. And then she just looked up and I feel like she had been behind like or underneath like a baseball cap for the weeks before that. It was still quite early on in the term. And then she just looked up and like the way she answered who just made this kind of like problematic comment. And then, like, the lecturer piped up and said, oh, maybe let's just something, something. Then she schooled him. Then she, like, basically told everyone about her observances for the last, you know, couple of weeks and how they were all...
read them to Phil.
Basically racist in their own way, and all their reading was basically racist, and maybe they should go read Toni Morrison's Playing in the Dark. And it was just glorious. And I remember looking at her and being like... I must be your friend. Like I was really kind of like, I was like a little girl about it. I was like, at playtime, I am going to hold your hand. Like, I was like, wait till this class is finished. she is incredible. And I knew she was. And then I think a week where she had to bring her writing in, and my God, the way this woman writes. So I did force her to hold my hand, and instead of the playground, I went to the pub. And lucky for me, she wanted to hold my hand. And so we became very, very good friends. And, she's moved back to California now, but I go and see her quite a lot. I'd be there if it wasn't for Corona, I think, this time. This kind of time of the year. So Elaine wrote, so when we met, she was like in the MA, she was writing kind of, or bringing in kind of earlier drafts of America Is Not the Heart to workshop, basically. The book is absolutely brilliant. It's about queer Filipinx women, in the Philippines, but also in California and the Bay Area. Oh my God, what is it about? It's about family, it's about love, it's about not feeling deserving of love. Someone's still gonna love you somehow anyway, and exploring how to let them. Oh, it's so much. All I can say is, because I always feel I'm doing it, some kind of injustice when I try and sum things up, I'm not very good at speaking about how things like truly affect me when they affect me that deeply.
Yeah.
America's Not Art is an absolutely brilliant book. I think in the lineage of Toni Morrison, Baldwin, and many other greats. So I would just say, like, yeah, if I've in any way sold it to you, do read it.
It's so funny because I actually received it in a PR pack when it came out. And I think, I'm not so sure, but I think that it came with a tamarind sweet. I don't know if it was that book.
Elaine probably would do something like this, or she did like a cassette as with it as well, like a really 90s cassette and a soundtrack for it as well.
That's all I remember, but I actually have it with me.
I remember the sweet.
I remember.
I remember sweetie.
Because I love tamarind. Could be her book. It might not be, but I do know that I got it in a PR pack and it came with something because I was very much like, ooh. So now you've like perfectly sold it and I've got loads of books that now I'm going to read it. So it, I have to read it now. Like that was like a perfect blurb.
Sorry, I feel like I should be way more succinct about my love of things.
Perfect. So, my darling from the Lions, absolutely beautiful. And as I'm saying, like, could be the thing. You know how you have like gateway drugs? This could be the into poetry. Shakespeare didn't do it. It was
if you want. If you really want some hard stuff, let me know. I'm full of recommendations.
Up until this point, I think there's a poem by Derek Walcott that I really, really like. I actually am a bit of a Shakespeare nerd and I do love a few of his sonnets. But I don't think I'm not an active poetry reader. So this is actually my first poetry collection that I read from beginning to end without stopping putting aside.
That is high praise.
And
that
I
is high praise.
But in terms of the message that you wanted to portray with the collection as a collective effort, when you put it out, what was the effect that you wanted from readers, maybe even writers?
I try not to require anything of a reader. You know, that is kind of what we were saying, like how you feel about a poem is what it's about. And if that hasn't been effectively communicated where it makes you feel absolutely nothing, then that's not your fault as the reader. That's often probably the fault of the poet or the poem. It's not working. So it kind of in that sort of space or that sphere of thinking, I don't want to force anything down any reader's throat or make them feel a certain way. And also to leave it open to their own interpretation, because if I'm here being like you said about, I just want you to cry, well, I don't know. I just don't know what the artistic, the point of that is, you know, like if I know what I require of you, do I require you at all? Otherwise I might just sit here with my little puppets and, you know, so I try not to. I hope that, you know, in a kind of a blanket way that people enjoy it, that they can have their own readings into it, that it might allow them to access other things and parts of themselves maybe. I think I tried to be really honest about feeling and difficult feelings as well in it. So hopefully that might be that allow other people maybe who read it to be really honest with difficult parts of themselves or with difficult things. But apart from that, there's nothing that any other burden that I want to put on a reader apart from, you know, like, hey, I hope you like it, kind of thing, you know?
I wanted to know whether it was autobiographical in a way, or when you're writing, do you pull from your own experiences? Because I did feel that it wasn't sectioned off in certain places, but each collection or each, I guess, chapter of poems maybe focused on an issue, whether it's sexual awakening, whether it's family, especially mums and mothers are very important. There was one poem that I really liked, and it was all about social mobility and class. And I think it's the one that starts off like, when I'm in love, I feel like I'm middle class. And I'm like, that was also the one where it's like the first line, I was like, ooh. I think that was also like, I think that might be my second favorite. And I loved what you did with that, which is, I think you had a lot of like what I would call middle class things, and then you kind of juxtaposed it with working class language, which I really loved and I thought was really smart. But yeah, when you're writing, do you pull from personal experiences? You know, when you have an idea for a poem, do you sit there and be like, oh, I want to encapsulate this feeling that I had on this day?
Yeah, so you turn it around. So the collection is broken into three parts. And I think that I wanted to do that because I did feel that there were certain shifts thematically, or maybe even sort of in a growing up way, or a different kind of revelation, or what I wanted to explore in each one way. So it's broken into three parts. I think as women, when we say that something is autobiographical, I do think that the way that the kind of the literary establishment has made it, that it makes as if we're lesser artists because of that. Mm. So there are little bells in my head being like, no, pretend it's not autobiographical, that it's all the figments of your imagination, because you're a great artist stamped with approval by male artists who say that, you know, like the confessional, the autobiographical, or say that the eye is dead and the lyric eye and all of that. And I think that it's sad that I feel that as a particular background, that I can't say like, yeah, a lot of that is autobiographical, because I feel like it suggests literarily that's less of a piece of work, that's less artistic.
I actually had a similar conversation with an episode that I had with Inua Ellens, and I was like, I'm really nervous because if I write just from my experience, do I run the risk of being a cliche? Does that make me less of an artist or a writer? Because in my head, you're only an amazing writer if you can think about something that is so far away from you and write it so well. But we actually came to the conclusion that no, because of course you will write what you know, but each production and each piece of writing will touch on bits of you, but the way you are so authentic to you that of course it's going to be artistic. So that's how I'm looking at it as, because I had literally quite the similar conundrum as well. I was like, oh, like if I write, and if I just write about, you know, being Raifa or parts of things that come from me, do I run the risk of also not being, you know, an amazing writer?
No, and I'm glad you talked about this with Inua as well, like being like someone who identifies as a male artist, and a multidisciplinary artist as well. I think it's definitely good to be concerned with it, and I think it's definitely good for us to, as writers, interrogate it. Like, how do I want to tell this particular story? From what angle? And also, even if you're writing autobiographically in anything, it's not like, you know, it's not memoir. You're not publishing your diary, and then there's no artistic, you know, no artistic devices or implements that you use apart from that. You don't just kind of say the thing and then you print it. That's not how it works. And there's still massive artistic like risks and decisions that are in there. I think also, just lastly on this, I think that some people have had more space and time in the history of our world to move away or to have the license or the comfortability to not have to tell a story from their particular personal viewpoint. Some people are have had more time and space to be more objective, but when you have, you know, only in the history of the world been seen as kind of human, and even by some people not, you writing from the I voice is actually maybe the most artistic and radical thing that you can absolutely do.
I love that. So moving on to, I guess, the writing process, and just for like the budding poets out there, how is your writing process like? Are you a, I've got a bazooka idea, you're on the train and a line just hits you, or a stanza just hits you and you know, get your phone out and write it on your notes app? Or are you more of a, let me sit down and think about exactly what I want to say and what, I guess, works for you when you're writing?
It's a good question. I'm a big, I know that, again, a contradiction. If I was in a workshop space, I would say to poets, write every day, that's important, or at least think about writing every day, you know, have a relationship with writing. And sometimes writing is reading as well, reading in a particular way. It can also be you thinking about writing because it's informing your work. But I would be lying if I said I write every day. I absolutely don't. I go through massive spells, like really, really long spells of not writing a thing. I'm in it at the moment. I need to let that book go and fly and do her thing before I even like grapple with what I am next obsessed with or what I really want to write next. And I don't know, but when I go for a run, I'm thinking about what I might be thinking about next.
Yeah.
And I'm open to that, but I am not writing. But I think I've only recently kind of really made peace with that and stopped flogging myself for not writing regularly. And actually, I think I do work most naturally like this. Like, I need to take my time and I need to give myself space and I need to be like, what are you interested in now? Like, I don't know, who do you fancy? What do you want to write? Like, you know, like, I want to, like, what's changed? And sometimes you have to wait for that, or I have to wait for that.
I have a good friend of mine who every time I complain, so I'm on my third week of not writing, and every time I complain, like, I haven't written this whole week, and they'll always say, yeah, you're living. Maybe you're living just to get material, and you don't know what each day brings. So I always say that to myself now, like, it's possibly turning into an excuse. I'll just sit up like, oh, I haven't written today, and in my head I'll be like, well, I'm living.
You're living. Yeah. And I don't know if it's an excuse, or maybe if an excuse, maybe you need it, or the writing needs it.
Yeah.
I think taking your time is a good thing. I took my time with that book, and I think it's a stronger book for it. If I had I think we need space and we need time. Or some people don't, some writers don't, but I do think there needs to be like a more open and honest conversation about all the different ways in which we work. You know, if someone is someone who needs to get up at 6 o'clock and get down 2,500 words, otherwise, you know, they actually feel like they've failed at life, then they absolutely need to do that. And I'm not here to be like, oh, no, sometimes it's like 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Sometimes it's, you know, like months before I can write again.
I'm a crash.
No one's right, no one's wrong. Huh?
I'm a crash. I'll do like a month of like, getting up at 6 a.m. to write 1,000 words, which is always my limit.
Yeah.
Now I've done a whole month of nothing.
Do you usually do that, like a month on, month off?
I don't even know. I think it's more so I'm going on how I'm feeling. The past few months, instead of writing, I've actually just been going to the gym in the morning over the past month. So I've just been going to the gym, doing yoga. So I do a lot of yoga. So I'm like,
nice. Oh,
that's what I want to do some yoga. But I do feel a bit guilty though.
I don't anymore. Maybe I'm worried that I don't feel guilty anymore.
What do you?
Bring back the guilt. I need some guilt. No, I don't want guilt.
Imagine you ending the Zoom call and be like, oh my God, I need to write. But no, keep that.
Do you feel like yoga is conducive to writing, or are they two absolutely different kind of spaces and like disciplines and practices for you?
That's actually a good question. I've never thought about yoga and writing. One, for me, yoga is just calming myself for the day. So maybe what I should do is yoga and then write. Maybe that will create a nice space. But no, I actually don't think so. I think, yeah, for me, yoga is just a time in the day where I can just focus on myself and that internal. But then I guess when I'm writing, and I say when I'm writing authentically, only because sometimes I'll write and I'll be like, what would somebody else think if they're reading this? Which I always try and get it out of my head. I'm always like, like from you. But I think it occupies the same space of solitude, maybe. Solitude. It's all quite insular as well. When I'm in my yoga bag, I'm very like myself. I think maybe it might occupy the same space. But that's all really that I can think of. But yeah, you should do it. I'm a big advocate. I bought myself a nice mat.
Have you got a nice mat? Is it really cute? Oh, it's really nice mat I brought in.
Pink. Okay, and just final few questions. I think you already touched on it, but what would be your biggest tip to like budding poets and people who really want to get into writing poetry and just forming a collection together as well? Because it's very different to editing a novel than, you know, editing a poetry collection.
I don't know if it is different because I've never edited a novel, but I don't think so. I think editing is very similar in the sense that you assess each word and each sentence with maybe the question, does this need to be here? Can this be a better, tighter, more like, you know, evocative sentence? Or what do I want each word and each sentence to do? Yeah. Is it doing it? Can it do it better? Yeah. So in that way, I think they're kind of similar or the same even.
Yeah.
Obviously form and stuff, and when you're editing, because line breaks and things, that will be different. Advice to poets, read. You can't read enough. You cannot read enough. And I think sometimes I meet people who really want books before they even, you can't read enough. You cannot read enough, and it will only inform and strengthen and fortify your work. And also you might even realize your lineage, your writerly lineage. Or you might read something and be inspired to take a new risk in your work. It might open up. You're like, oh, this is what I was trying to get to, actually. It's something like what so-and-so is doing here. Read and give yourself time and space. And there's no hurry. You do not have to have a book on a shelf by the time you're 25. You don't get any points for that.
Yeah.
You might by some people, but like, you know, not sustainable, not get to a place where you think that you will be able to stand by that book for a very, very, very long time. Not that you feel like you rushed it or you're trying to prove something to yourself or other people. So read, take your time, and read some more and take more time.
Yeah.
Perfect. And enjoy it and have fun. I think sometimes like people forget how like have it's fun. We've chosen to do this for a reason, right?
I actually got another question, which is, when did you know that you were a poet, as in poetry was the form for you?
That is a good question. I had already had a degree in, I did American studies and creative writing for my undergrad. But the whole time I was doing creative writing, I was writing novels basically, or trying to write them, and they were never really going very well. I would So even after that, I was still, writing kind of, I was writing prose. And it wasn't until after university and then reading War Sands, Teaching My Mother How to Give Birth, and then starting to go to certain poetry nights in London and join certain collectives like Burn After Reading. And I was like, this is cool, you know, let me try and see if I can, like, can I write poems? That's when it clicked for me. That's when I was like, no, this is my form. This is my jam. This is what I think I've been trying to get at the whole time. But I was just kind of dealing with too many words when I was sort of writing long form. And now I could condense it. And also, on my school reports, when I used to write these stories, there always used to be like, Rachel was a good writer, but she can never finish or sustain like a whole story. And I never got to the end. And that was kind of like always something, like even through like my degree, it was like, oh, but like, what do you think's the ending? And I was like, oh, I'm not really sure. I'd kind of make something up. And it never kind of had a real kind of trajectory. A poem doesn't have to really end.
Yeah,
and that's what I loved about them. I didn't have to kind of fulfill my bad school report, good bad school report with critique, and I could eradicate the critique because a poem doesn't need to end. You don't need to do a neat little bow at the end. In fact, a poem, I think, a good ending in a poem is one that you do not expect, and leaves the reader in a space where they have to sit or deal or create an ending for themselves. So I think that is also why I love poems. And you can just start in a new place with a new one.
But with that, where can people find you? Are you on socials if they want to get in touch?
I'm on Twitter, which I'm a bit like an auntie. I'm only on Twitter. And even though I did create a burner Insta for a reading the other time. Yeah, but I'm gonna delete immediately after I have to do another reading on Insta. that's not my job. That's not my vibe. I'm on Twitter, Rachel N.A. Long, and you can buy the book, which is published by the amazing Picador, from any good bookstore.
Lovely.
Maybe even bad ones. I've never been to a bad bookstore, but I mean, maybe it's in good and bad bookstores.
Oh, I don't know what a bad
book. All the ones in between. Yeah, I know, I'm trying to think now. Like, maybe when you just get looked at in a certain way when you walk in, maybe those ones are bad ones. Yeah, don't buy them from there. Buy the ones there, you're welcomed at the door.
Next projects, do you have anything in the pipeline, anything that you mean that you can share anyway, that you're really excited to work on and that people should look out for?
I'm running and I'm thinking about all the next things.
That's right, Rachel's living. Rachel's living, as am I.
Yeah, that's really dangerous because that's a massive excuse. Bad life. It feels fabulous.
It's like the best excuse. It's like, oh, I can just drinking tea and I'll be like, I should be writing, but I'm living. Who knows what this moment could bring?
I love it.
That I could write about in the future. That is not now. But thank you so much.
All kinds of problems here. All kinds of problems. I come into your door and I'm going to blame you and no writing gets done ever. Thank you for it. It's a good license. I need it.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much.
And welcome.
I hope to see you very soon and read more of your stuff.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
And thank you for listening. It's something that the society has done.